This was a terribly violent time. Violence the likes of which we can't even really wrap our minds around because they did things so differently, and they did not value decency and humanity, it seems like, from time to time because of the violence that was present in the Old Testament world. Specifically, we're going to be talking about 11th century B.C., and it seems like even sometimes commands that God would give people just seem so terribly violent, but it was just part of a different world and a different society that we don't even understand. We know a little bit about ancient warfare. And when we talk about ancient warfare, we're talking about something that has been kind of glamorized and fictionalized a lot on media, and to a certain point has been sterilized because of pictures like what we have up here. We've kind of gotten a glimpse of what we think ancient warfare looks like. But the reality is we will never see ancient warfare, and even at that time, you would have not seen warfare. We have the privilege and sometimes, unfortunately, the pain of seeing video and pictures depicted in media of our current warfare and our current military when they have to engage. We can see what that looks like because of the media that's available to us. You would never see ancient warfare unless you were seeing it across the edge of your shield. Modern warfare, we have the privilege of being able to kill from a distance. We have the privilege of being able to destroy from a distance. Ancient warfare, you had to engage face to face. You would see the person you were engaging with, and you would see the person that you were going to kill. And you would see whatever was going on in their eyes. You could see the fear in their eyes. You could see the savagery in their eyes. You could see the glazed look in their eyes if perhaps it took a little liquid courage to get them to the battlefield. And the one thing you would never want to see in their eyes was calm. Because if you looked to your adversary in ancient warfare and you saw calm in their eyes, you knew that you were in the presence of a professional, and you would probably die. Ancient warfare, they engaged in close quarters. Oftentimes, they didn't wear a lot of clothing because they didn't understand germs, they didn't understand bacteria, but they knew metal and clothing and puncture wounds would often cause them to lose limbs or get infections. Ancient warfare was always, always big wins, small loses. If you were the biggest and the baddest, you got to stay put and you got to conquer. And if you were the smallest, you had a few options. You could die. You could run and hope that they couldn't catch you and hope that you could establish somewhere else that maybe they didn't want or maybe they wouldn't want immediately. Or you could pay tribute. You could offer the bigger and the badder of the foes something, a piece of what you had, some of your stuff, and maybe they would leave you alone. Later, the mafia would perfect this and call it protection. But those were your options if you were the smallest. And if you survived warfare, you might lose a limb. And if you died on the battlefield, after you were used up as a human shield, your body would be left, there would be no burial, there would be no service, and the birds of the air and the beasts of the field would feast on your flesh. What an inspiring way to go into worship today. 1 Samuel chapter 17. It says, now the Philistines gathered their armies for battle, and they were gathered at Soko, which belongs to Judah. And Saul and the men of Israel were gathered and encamped in the valley of Elah and drew up in line of battle against the Philistines. And the Philistines stood on the mountain on the one side, and Israel stood on the mountain on the other side, with the valley between them. And there came out from the camp of the Philistines a champion named Goliath of Gath, whose height was 6 cubits and a span. He had a helmet of bronze on his head. He was armed with a coat of mail, and the weight of the coat was 5,000 shekels of bronze. And he had a bronze armor on his legs and a javelin of bronze slung between his shoulders. The shaft of his spear was like a weaver's beam, and his spear's head weighed 600 shekels of iron. So we get essentially the image of this ancient battlefield. The Philistines on one side, the Israelites on the other, and a valley between them. And out emerges from the Philistines a name of which we're all familiar because this is one of the first Bible stories we learn, a man by the name of Goliath. And just some facts about Goliath, just to kind of paint a picture. I stole this from the Sunday school department just to show you what Goliath would look like. But let's look at some facts about Goliath. It says he was 6 cubits and a span. Now, we have an understanding of ancient weights and measures and conversions. 6 cubits and a span is about 9.5 feet tall. So he's a tall drink of water. Now, the tallest person that we have on record living in the kind of secular history is a man about 8.5 feet tall. And so some people have a really hard time wrapping their mind around this man who was a foot taller than anybody we have any modern record of knowing. But you have to keep in mind that heights over the years have changed. We are actually taller now than people in history. This time, 11th century BC, most men would have been about 5.5 feet tall. So it makes some people feel, now scholars agree that 6 cubits in a span, that was 9.5 feet. Some people feel better to say that Goliath couldn't have been any more than 6.5 or 7 feet tall. It's just impossible. And if that makes you feel better, if that makes you believe the story, then you can believe he's still 1.5 feet taller than every guy on the battlefield. So that's fine. But our understanding, the scholarly understanding of weights and measures, he was 9.5 feet tall. If you are a 6 foot tall man in this room, you would have been eye level with his belly button. And his bronze armor, 500 shekels, a shekel is about 1/2 ounce. So 5,000 shekels was 155 pounds of armor that he wore as a coat. So if those of you who like to shed your sweatshirt when you step onto the scale so you don't get that extra third of a pound, imagine 155-pound coat. And then his spear had an iron point on it. It was 600 shekels, or right under 20 pounds. So the spear that would have to be able to hold a 20-pound point on it would be quite thick, and imagine the man who is able to maneuver it and use it in battle. And Goliath, because of his height, would have been in the second rank because he would have been taller than the first rank, and he could reach over them with this mighty spear with a 20-pound arrow on the front of it and kill and kill and kill. And if you were the biggest, you always won. If you were the smallest, you always lost. Verse 8 says, he, Goliath, stood and shouted to the ranks of Israel, why have you come out to draw up for battle? Am I not a Philistine? Are you not servants of Saul? Choose a man for yourselves and let him come down to me. If he is able to fight with me and kill me, then we will be your servants. But if I prevail against him and kill him, then you shall be our servants and serve us. And the Philistine said, I defy the ranks of Israel this day. Give me a man that we may fight together. When Saul and all Israel heard these words of the Philistine, they were dismayed and greatly afraid. Day after day, Goliath would come out and make this challenge. It went on for 40 days. It went on for over a month. He would make this challenge, and people looked to Saul, who was the king. And Saul was actually the king because he was taller than most of the people. He was a stout gentleman himself. That's why he was the king. And they looked to their king. They placed their hope in their king. And this is kind of where our story intersects with their story, because we all know that we place our hope in what we trust. And more specifically, we place our hope in who we trust. We place our hope in who we trust. This is why it is so easy for us to resent our parents, because they are some of the first people that we put our trust in. And it is so easy for them to disappoint us, and so we put our trust in them, and they disappoint, and that's why you resent your parents. That's family therapy, and that is free. But we always look to the parents next door of our friends, and they always seem to be nicer to their kids than your parents were to you, and their food tasted better. And then they would bring you back to your parents, and they would say, you know, little Jimmy was such a delight, and your parents are like, little Jimmy's not a delight. Who is this? But that's why it's so easy, because since your parents are the first people you put trust in, they're the first people you have hope in, and when you get disappointed, that's what broods resentment. So we put our hope in what we trust in. And the challenge is put out, and Saul should have stepped up to the challenge, and he is conspicuously absent. He is cowering with fear with the other soldiers. and his credibility would diminish with every day that he wouldn't step to the challenge. And it shone a light on a glaring truth that we discovered just a little bit before all this happened. God never wanted Israel to have a king. God established Israel about 400 years before this story. God established Israel as something called a theocracy, which is something where God made the law, God established the law, and then he would appoint judges to kind of administer the law. And that put Israel above every country for years and years and years ahead of the game, because every country had a king. You know, and the king established the law, and the king was the law and could kind of change the law and became the law. And if he broke the law, he would just change it. And God said, that's not how we're going to do this. I'm going to make the law, and then we're just going to have a few people in place to kind of administer the law. Kings didn't like laws. So a few years before this story with Goliath happens, if you turn back to 1 Samuel chapter 8, 1 Samuel chapter 8, we get a glimpse of how this happens. It says, when Samuel, that was one of the prophets of God, one of the men who had been responsible for the law, when Samuel became old, he made his sons judges over Israel. 1 Samuel 8:3 says, yet his sons did not walk in his ways, but turned aside after gain. They took bribes and perverted justice. So Samuel was a good man, and he appointed his sons to succeed him as judges, and they were rotten kids. Then all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah and told him, behold, you are old, and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now appoint for us a king to judge, just like all the other nations. Come on, Samuel, all the cool kids have a king, and we want a king. But see, God had established Israel for a very specific purpose. God had established Israel to be a light to the rest of the world. God wanted Israel, when they would have success in warfare, when they would have success in crops, when they would have success in wealth, he wanted the rest of the world to look at them and say, who is your God? So they were established for a very specific purpose. And verse 6 says, but the thing displeased Samuel when they said, give us a king to judge us. Samuel prayed to the Lord, and the Lord said to Samuel, obey the voice of the people and all that they say to you, for they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me for being king over them. Now then, obey their voice, only you shall solemnly warn them and show them the ways of the king who shall reign over them. God tells Samuel, look, it's not you, it's me. They're not rejecting you, they're rejecting me. It's like, so give them the king that they're asking for, but make sure you tell them it isn't going to be as easy as you think. If you have a king, he will tax your stuff. He will tax your land and tax your herd, and he will force your sons to fight for him, and he will force your daughters to serve him. So just know that having a king isn't all it's cracked up to be. But what this does is this sets the stage for one of the most thoroughly detailed stories that we have in the Bible. In fact, it's one of the most thoroughly detailed stories that we have not just in the Bible, but all of antiquity. And that is the story of King David. King David was a reluctant, confident, humble hero. And he ends up being the second king of Israel. Saul was the first king of Israel. And in the story that we're reading today, David was just a boy. But as we study the life of David over the next few weeks, we'll talk about him. You'll learn a few things about David, about his reluctancy, about his humility, about his confidence. You'll learn that David actually loved the law, which was weird. Kings, again, didn't love the law. Kings like to change the law. And even when the law condemned David, he would be broken by the law. And throughout his entire imperfect reign, and it was a very imperfect reign, he never forgot who the real king was. So that's the man we're going to study for a few weeks. What David would know, and what Saul would have to learn, and what many of the kings of Israel would struggle with, and what you and I struggle with from time to time, is the fact that success confuses the best of us. If we get a little bit of success, whether it's that parenting win, or whether it's an academic success, or a vocational success, maybe an economic success, we start to sit on the throne of our own life, because we start to place our hope and our trust in ourselves, because we put our trust in the things that we hope, and we put our hope in the things that we trust. So success can oftentimes confuse us, and it certainly confused the kings of Israel. Going back to our story, we stopped at 1 Samuel 17:11. When Saul and all Israel heard these words of the Philistine, they were dismayed and greatly afraid. So David shows up in this story, and he's about 15 years old, and he was essentially bringing a care package to his brothers. His brothers were serving in Saul's army. He was taking care of he was a shepherd. He was taking care of his dad's sheep. And he brings a care package to his brothers. And he hears Goliath, coming out. You know, he's been doing it day after day after day, going on, spewing off the mouth. And when David hears the challenge, he is not dismayed, and he is not terrified, and he is not fearful. He is offended. He asks a question, and he asks a question with so much clarity. It's clarity that no one else in this story has presented. David asks in verse 26, it says, David said to the men who stood by him, "What shall be done for the man who kills this Philistine and takes away the reproach from Israel?" What do you mean? We haven't really looked at it like that. Who will remove him? We would hope that our king would remove him, but our king is over there hiding in the bushes with the rest of us. Who is expected to go fight this guy? And he's bringing disgrace to Israel, and he finishes up that verse. He says, "For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God?" And nobody had asked that question. David calls Goliath an uncircumcised Philistine. It basically just means you are outside of God's covenant. You are outside of God's protection. Philistines were trying to take land from the Israelites that had been promised to them by God. Why hadn't somebody done something about this? So where it gets back to Saul, and David wants to fight Goliath. Of course, Saul doesn't want that. And David is persistent, and Saul gives David his armor. Now, Saul was a tall drink of water in his own right, and David was a 15-year-old kid, and his armor is big and cumbersome, and it doesn't work. And Saul doesn't want David to fight Goliath. And David speaks to Saul in verse 36 of chapter 17. And he says, "Your servant has struck down both lions and bears, and this uncircumcised Philistine shall be like one of them." Not because I'm a soldier, not because I have military experience, but because, the next part of that verse, he has defied the armies of the living God. And David said, "The Lord who delivered me from the paw of the lion and from the paw of the bear will deliver me from the hand of this Philistine." David was a shepherd, and oftentimes shepherds would have to defend themselves against wild animals that would come and attack the flock, and he's like, "Look, I've seen lions, I've seen bears, and I handled it. And the same God that led me through that will lead me into battle against this Philistine." He's like, "I'm good, but I'm not that good. Understand, this is a God thing. And an enemy of God's people is an enemy of God." So he says, "King Saul, pick me. Let me do what nobody else in your army is willing to do. Let me do what you yourself will not do." So David is one of the most detailed stories that we have in Scripture, because we get the chronological order of his reign, and we get story after story after story. But we also get, in kind of this mix of third person versus first person, we get David's thoughts. Because David was a bit of an artsy fellow, and he wrote songs and he wrote poems. And we have a lot of that stuff. We have the book of Psalms, many of which were written by David. And if you look at Psalm 25, you get a little glimpse of David's psyche, a little glimpse of how David looked at things and what he thought. Psalm 25, verse 1 and 2 says, "To you, O Lord, I lift up my soul. O my God, in you I trust." Where is your trust, David? Is it in your talent? Is it in your ability? Is it because you're the best shepherd on the block? He says, "My trust is in God." This is the posture that God wanted the Israelite people to have. This is the posture that God desires you and I to have. Complete and total trust in him. It goes on in verse 3 of chapter 25. It says, "Indeed, none who wait for you shall be put to shame. Indeed, none who wait for you shall be put to shame." And then David says something the kings do not say. David wrote something that kings do not write. In verse 5, he says, lead me. But David, you're the king. Kings don't ask for guidance. Kings don't ask for leadership. Kings guide and kings lead. And David says, God, lead me in your truth and teach me. For you are the God of my salvation. For you I wait all the day long. That's how David approached his situations. So the story continues, and David goes to fight Goliath. And the soldiers on the Israelite camp are looking, and they say, it's a boy. It's Jesse's son's kid brother. And the Philistines look out, and they say, it's a boy. And Goliath looks out and says, it's a boy, because he was bigger. And the Israelites say, Saul is sending out a boy, and if we lose, we're servants. If we lose, we are servants, and Saul is sending out a boy. And Goliath keeps repeating his threats. It's a boy. I think I'm a little dog. And then David steps forward and says, this is the David verse. This is the verse we want to kind of plant our faith on. David steps forward, and in verse 45, it says, David said to the Philistine, you come to me with a sword and with a spear and with a javelin. But I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. This day the Lord will deliver you into my hand, and I will strike you down and cut off your head, and I will give the dead bodies of the host of the Philistines this day to the birds of the air and to the wild beasts of the earth, that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel. And that all this assembly may know, the Lord saves not with sword and spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hand. David looks right at the 9-foot-6-inch giant and says, I'm going to kill you. I'm going to kill you till you're dead. And when I kill you, all of your people and all of my people are going to know that a giant was taken down by a 15-year-old kid because we serve a mighty, mighty God. So David picks up his sling. Now this is actually called a shepherd's sling because that's what shepherds would have used. So he would have been adept at this. And a lot of times you'll see them with a pouch on it. That was kind of a later addition. A sling is just a piece of rope. And they would, if it didn't have a pouch on it, they would just weave the rope around the rock. And I watched a couple of YouTube videos, and just FYI, you cannot become a shepherd sling expert in 15 minutes on a Saturday. So I cannot show you how this works. But this is, we'll have that trustees meeting about the broken window after church. But this was a shepherd sling, just a piece of rope and a couple of smooth stones about the size of tennis balls. And David goes up to Goliath, picks up a few stones, loads up his sling. Thunk. Right between the eyes of the mighty giant. Now, the language is unclear, but scholars speculate that the rock did not kill Goliath. It hit him in the forehead, it knocked him face forward, perhaps concussed him, perhaps knocked him out. Then David runs up, grabs Goliath's sword, and cuts off his head. And we are fairly certain that was fatal. We are not certain about the rock, but we're pretty sure the head coming off, that's probably what definitely killed him. And when that happened, the Philistines turned and ran. And the Israelites slaughtered them. And they plundered their camp. Talked at the beginning, you know, big always won over small. And if you were a Philistine, you probably had never retreated before. Why would you need to? You had a 9.5-foot champion. So when they turned and ran, they weren't particularly good at it because they didn't have an exit strategy. And they got slaughtered. And the Israelites enriched themselves on the plunder of the Philistine camp. And so it was with David, and so it is for those of us who put our hope in the Lord. When your hope is in the Lord, you see clearly and you walk confidently and you walk humbly when your hope is in the Lord. That's something that David knew. That's something that we oftentimes have to learn. Can we go to the next slide, please? When your hope is in the Lord, you see clearly, you act confidently, you walk humbly. You recognize that you cannot control outcomes. Outcomes have too many variables. Outcomes have too many extremes, but you put your weight of your life against the one who has the whole world in his hands. And you declare every morning some version of Psalm 25:2, Psalm 25:5, which says, O God, in you I trust, for you I wait all the day long. Oh my God, in you I trust, for you I wait all the day long. When life is going really good, imagine if you declared this every day. When life is going really good, when things are going really good at work, when you walk into a room and you are the smartest person in the room, and like I've told all three services, at some service today I'll be the smartest person in the room. I'm just not going to tell you which service. It's not this one. I told them all that. But when you walk in and you're not, when things aren't going well, when there's tragedy and when there's adversity and when there are giants, oh Lord my God, in you I put my trust. I wait on you all the day long. Anytime we look at the Old Testament, I always remind you that we have to find ourselves in the story. And we like to think of ourselves sometimes as King David, that plucky underdog that needs to stand up to his giants with the power of God. And maybe even sometimes you relate to Goliath because you've maybe abused your power, abused your privilege. You have a problem with bullying that you have to keep in check from time to time. But ultimately, this story doesn't revolve around David or Goliath. This is a story about Saul. This is a story about a king who was supposed to lead, a king who was supposed to keep his army accountable, a king who was supposed to step to the giants and be unafraid, and who cowered in the bushes with the rest of his men. Jesus reflects on this principle when he's speaking with his disciples. In John chapter 16, verse 33, he says, I've said these things to you that in me you may have peace. In the world, you will have tribulation. In the world, you will have tragedy. In the world, you will have adversity. In the world, you will have giants. But take heart, for I have overcome the world. We often talk about putting our trust in Jesus, and we call that something. Everybody calls that something. When you make a decision to follow Jesus, when you put your trust in Jesus, and you can call it salvation, you can call it getting saved, being born again, but that moment of clarity, that moment of decision, when you say, I believe what the Bible says about Jesus is true. I believe that he came for me, he lived for me, he died for me, and he rose for me. We call that salvation. We call putting our trust in Jesus. And when you put your trust in Jesus, you are putting your trust in someone who has guaranteed you that you will experience tribulation, you will experience tragedy, you will experience adversity. And then he tells us that he's already overcome that. When we put our trust in Jesus, we are surrendering to a God who has overcome the tragedy that we will ever experience. And you will step to the giants. And you can fearlessly step to the giants and they will fall before you. And we like that. But oftentimes you will step to the giants and you will proclaim the truth and they will not fall. And you will have to walk through the adversity, walk around the giant, walk under the giant where the weight is on your shoulders. But you will never be alone.
They say sometimes you win some, sometimes you lose some. Right now, I'm losing bad. I've stood on the stage night after night, reminding the broken it'll be alright. But right now, oh right now, I just can't. there's nothing to bring me down. But what will I say when I'm held to the flame like I am right now? I know you're able and I know you can save through the fire with your mighty hand. But even if you don't, my hope is you alone. They say it only takes a little faith to move a mountain. Well, good thing, a little faith is all I got right now. But God, when you choose to leave mountains unmovable, oh, give me the strength to be able to sing, it is well with my soul. I know you're able and I know you can save through the fire with your mighty hand. But even if you don't, alone. I know the sorrow and I know the hurt would all go away if you just say the word. But even if you don't, my hope is you alone. You've been faithful, you've been good all my days. Jesus,
you may be familiar with the story of Horatio Spafford. Horatio Spafford was a lawyer in the 1860s. He was a Christian man and he was a wealthy man. He bought up a lot of Chicago real estate and made a lot of investments in the Chicago area in the 1860s. And in 1871, something very significant happened in Chicago. For you history buffs, you will know that it burned to the ground, the Great Chicago Fire. And he lost much of what he had. Not too long after that, Horatio Spafford lost his 2-year-old son to scarlet fever. And so he decided with his wife and his 4 remaining children that they would go on holiday together. And he would send them ahead because he had to stay and complete some business, and they would take a transatlantic voyage. And he would get a telegram from his wife a few days later that would say, "Saved alone," for the ship sank and was lost at sea, and she was the only one that survived without her children. And it was that gentleman, Horatio Spafford, who suffered a great loss, both material losses and both the loss of family and children, who penned the words, "When peace like a river attendeth my way, when sorrows like sea billows come, whatever my lot, thou hast taught me to say, it is well with my soul." See, what Horatio Spafford knew and what David knew and what we have to learn is that we cannot control outcomes. In fact, this story, this story of David and Goliath did not make print, did not make the final draft of the Bible because David killed Goliath. This story with a different outcome is just as significant. If David let loose the sling and the rock struck Goliath in the shoulder, and he shrugged it off and he crushed David under his thumb, this is still a story of epic proportion and epic consequence for you and I. Because it is not about the outcome of the fight. It is about the fact that a man stood up and said, "O Lord my God, in you I put my trust. I wait on you all the day long." Regardless of the outcome, in times of plenty and in times of want, in times of success and in times of tragedy, in times of giants, "O Lord my God, in you I put my trust. I wait on you all the day long." So that's our challenge. When we talk about trust, it's not a spiritual word, it's not a Bible word, it's just a word. It's a verb, and it means the same thing in your practical life as it means spiritually. In your practical life, if you trust something, it means that you can put the entirety of your weight on it. In the spiritual sense, if you trust God and if you put your trust in Jesus Christ, that simply means you are putting your weight on Jesus. You're putting your weight on the one who has promised that, yes, there will be troubles, but you will never be alone, and I've already overcome all that. And you're putting your weight on the one who has the world in his hands. So I encourage you to start your day, to end your day, to live your day. "Oh God, in you I put my trust. I will wait on you all the day long. It is well with my soul."